Hi, and welcome back to the Guru Performance We Do Science podcast. This is episode 98, and today I'm extremely pleased to revisit a topic that covered in 2014, July 2014. So today I've got Professors Stu Phillips and Kevin Tipton. Hi guys, how are you doing?
Hey Laurent, good to be back.
That's good. Guys. There was a bit of a pregnant pause there. I was going worried. I thought you guys had done a runner. Not again. Right. Okay. So obviously everyone can listen to that podcast that we did back in 2014. Large numbers of people had downloaded that, which is cool. But I do feel that it's time that we can revisit this topic. As I was saying off air, I'm aware that there have been some developments, and also there's things we didn't discuss. Plus, I've probably gained another brain cell, hopefully, in that time. So hopefully we can tackle this to have an interesting conversation. But just in case the listeners haven't yet listened to that episode number 5, bearing in mind this is episode 98, and they may not know who you are, as unlikely as I would imagine that is. Kevin, do you want to just quickly give us some background as to who you are, and then Stu, you can follow on from that.
Sure. Professor Kevin Tipton. I'm a professor of sport, health, and exercise sciences at the University of Stirling in Scotland. And you can probably tell from my accent that that's not where I'm originally from. So I was trained in Bob Wolf's lab in Texas and worked there for almost 12 years, and that's actually how Stu and I, we worked together for a couple of years back in the old days, I didn't have much time then either, so we both sort of do similar protein type work, stemming at least partially from that training.
So, Stu, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, Stuart Phillips. I'm a professor in the Department of Kinesiology here at McMaster University, so coming to you from the other side of the Atlantic. As Kevin mentioned, I also trained with Bob Wolf, where I think it would be fair to say I got probably the best mentorship in the world from one of the top guys, and Kevin and I spent it was almost 3 glorious years hanging out and doing some good science there. And, you know, he and I were actually rugby friends before that, but we've maintained a friendship across the thousands of miles and kilometers, and we do work in the same area, obviously.
No, that's great, because it's clearly can be a bit of a lonely world working either as a practitioner or as a researcher in these fields. And it's, I think, one thing I've certainly gained from the sort of work that I'm now doing is the people that you meet, whether it's at conferences or over these sorts of projects. It can be a wonderful community of people. And on the whole, most of you are quite friendly, as long as people aren't making up studies. So
that tends to annoy people.
It does a little bit, yeah. So I can see. So What I want to do is just define a few things here, because we're going to talk about protein. It's a big topic. And what's interesting about protein, I find, in the sort of sport and exercise sciences or health and fitness realm, is there are all sorts of topics that induce issues that go beyond sort of healthy, rational debates. And by that, I mean, you know, people getting issues over keto diets or carbohydrates, whether it's good or bad or whatever. But protein seems to be sort of, for the most part, only ever really talked about with extreme levels of enthusiasm. It's always a positive topic, for the most part. I know we just referenced actually something which we'll get into at the end of this podcast, possibly. There are some things. But Stu, why is protein, of all the areas, you know, why is protein so interesting and so engaging, you think?
Well, I think you know, most athletes appreciate that when you partition out body composition, obviously fat and bone-free mass, or what we generally call lean mass, and the majority of which we concern ourselves would be skeletal muscle. But, you know, bone is important too, so not to forget that. But and protein is the constituent that makes up all of those structures. It also is responsible for enzyme function, neurotransmitters. So there's a variety of things that it does. And probably the one difference I point out to people between carbohydrate and fat and protein is that you can store lots of carbohydrate, labile stores like glycogen. You can store lots of fat, obviously. But protein, really, there's no place to put it. You kind of have to use it when you eat it. Or, you know, your body takes off the nitrogen group, forms urea, and then you're left with a carbon skeleton that you either oxidize or turn into glucose or do something like that. So it's a little bit different than the other two, and it has a predominant role, obviously, in the structures in our body.
So a few podcasts ago, I had a really interesting chat with John Hawley. I've done a few podcasts with him, but that whole podcast sort of got into the topic of integrative biology or integrative exercise science. And we sort of got into all sorts of interesting stuff. Some of what John was saying possibly was a little controversial to some of the listeners, insofar as we're so used to talking in the sports science field, a lot of very mechanistic stuff. And one argument or one point that came up in our discussion was, as it applies to practice, which of course is my main interest here, is a danger of going down too much of the sort of the reductionist thought process. And so too, that goes as a big theme in nutrition. We talk about macros, protein, carbohydrates, fats, talk about calories, we talk about, you know, all sorts of things. But from an integrative perspective, Kevin, you know, I mean, the role of protein is not just an isolated macronutrient in terms of why, you know, why we should be interested in protein. Perhaps you could elucidate the sort of the importance it is to the whole body, if that makes sense.
I think so. You know, to sort of add to Stu's comment on the importance of it, with your question about that, it's also the, as you just alluded to, the only macronutrient that whose primary function is not, the primary function of which is not fuel. You know, so the other two, fat and carbohydrates, are primarily, their main function is to provide fuel, where protein has so many other roles. And so that kind of leads to this question, which is all the different roles, as Stu said, it's the main component of muscle, other than, of course, water, but enzymes, structural protein, and so many other situations. It's the transporters, etc. So hormones, you know, we can go on and on about all the different functions of protein. And so, as far as nutritionally, of course, you know, to be able to optimize all those functions, you need to have the right amount of protein. And of course, that.
Yeah, so I guess what I was leaning towards in terms of sort of the integrative comment was protein, like many things, obviously, but protein is, it pretty much relates to almost everything, doesn't it, one way or the other. So the relevance of this conversation is not just about muscle, it's not just about hypertrophy, it relates to a huge variety of things. So I guess, Stu, maybe you could help us initially here then by defining what protein is. You know, what is the textbook definition of protein?
Yeah, I mean, textbook-wise, we talk about protein as consisting of 20 different amino acids, 11 of which are considered to be essential amino acids. And, you know, those are the amino acids that you, excuse me, 9 of which are essential. And those are the ones that you have to get in your diet because you have no way of making them. And as I said, if you don't have those amino acids, then you probably necessarily have to break down some of the proteins in your body to get them. So the analogy I use, and one that I think most people can wrap their minds around is if you're building a wall and the wall's made out of 20 different bricks, then there are 9 bricks that need to come from somewhere else other than your own body to make the wall complete. And so if you don't have them in enough or sufficient quantity, you know, the measure of which we talk about is being a protein quality, in other words, how many essential amino acids or how much of the essential amino acids they contain, then you have a hard time building the wall, so everything slows down. So I think most athletes sort of tend to err on the side of, you know, some protein is good, more is better. But again, I remind everybody that you, when you dump those amino acids, those bricks into the system, if they're not used, and usually within a fairly short time frame, it's pretty difficult to put them and stock them away somewhere. Usually you take the nitrogen off and that's the end of the amino acid.
So when I listened to the last podcast, that was definitely your analogy of the muscle like a brick wall was a very good takeaway from that. So I'm pleased you came up with that again. But in terms of what it is and why it's important to the body, there are people that are going to ask that question with different sort of perspectives, different requirements. You've got your everyday people who may do no exercise at all, and of course you've got athletes, and we'll focus mostly on the variations of athletes from recreational to performance. We'll get into that in a minute, but just for general people, Kevin, why, you know, because a lot of them will go in conversation, I've certainly had this in conversation with people where I may have, you know, determine whether or not they're having enough protein, and their sort of response would be, well, I'm not an athlete, I don't need to eat that much protein. Why would just even the average person want to be concerned with protein intake?
So when you say average person, are you talking about...
Well, a non-athlete, a non-athlete.
Right, but you're saying someone who's active and does exercise as opposed to the true average person, which doesn't do a dang thing.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, I suppose it would depend on their goals as to how much protein they need, and also there are situational kind of considerations that need to be considered. Obviously, there's a minimum amount before you start getting into deficiencies, and that's going to lead to illnesses, et cetera. And I'm certain we're not talking about that level. We're talking about, you know, what they actually need. And I think, you know, Sue, you could see if you comment on this, but probably those type of people that you're talking about aren't going to need huge amounts of protein. Some new studies have shown if maybe they're injured or something or trying to lose weight, then maybe a little bit more. But we're talking really about, you know, sort of high 1.6, 1.7 grams per kilo, and that range seems to be very little supported argument anyway that anybody like that would need a whole lot more than that. Stu, is that about what you'd say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you build it up from a basal level, which I consider to be the RDA, and say 0.8 grams per kilo per day would probably cover everybody just fine. The question after, let's say you weigh 70 kilograms and you're 45 years old and you're a man, then you probably require about 2,500 calories. That means that at 70 kilos of 0.8, you're only eating 56 grams of protein. And you've got to figure out where the remainder of your, you know, approximately 2,100 calories are going to come from. So that's basically down to carbohydrates and fats. And, you know, I won't go into the, you need to eat less carbs, more fat, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But it really does present most people, I think, with a bit of a dilemma as to how to get the energy that they need. So there are a few things I say to, you know, mere mortals who are non-athletes about protein. First, it's very, of all of the macronutrients, it's the most satiating. So in other words, after you've eaten it, you feel full. the desire to eat takes longer to return. Second, because of the satiety, it may help you if you're trying to control your weight, not necessarily lose weight, but I think if you're trying to lose weight, and it is also advantageous because it protects the tissue that we'd like to protect, which is muscle. And then beyond that, I mean, the slight, and it is pretty small, but the greatest thermic effect when you eat food, it comes from protein. So your body energy expenditure goes up for just a small amount of time after you've eaten, and it goes up more the more protein that you eat. So all of those things over a longer period of time might add up to some advantages for, you know, metabolically speaking or body composition wise for an average non-athletic person. But I agree with Kevin about the number. I think, you know, beyond about 2 times the RDA, the returns that you get back are, they diminish. So, you know, up to say twice the RDA, I don't generally like to recommend much higher, because I just, you know, it's not that you can't eat it, it's that people can't make use of that protein.
Sure. Well, there's various. Yeah, sorry, Kevin. Go on.
Yeah, what about is like also when you know, you got to take diet records, you know, of all different types with a grain of salt, but it's, you know, when you do those kind of things, at least in the countries that we live in, and probably at least a fair few of your listeners are in, that's pretty much what people eat anyway. Mm. You know, it's the women will eat down into the level 1s, 1.2, 1.3, and then men are more like 1.4 up to 1.7 or 8. And that just seems to fall out if they're not, unless they're specifically trying to increase it or decrease it. So it seems to fall into that kind of niche naturally in the types of foods that most of people eat anyway.
Yeah, and I the reason why I'm mentioning this is because, you know, if you turn on the television and you listen to people talking about nutrition and diets just for the general population, if you go into supermarkets, dare I say it, look on social media, whatever, you do have an awful lot of people, you know, espousing the benefits of protein for pretty much anything. And I find that interesting because obviously off the back of that is an industry, whether it's food supplements or, you know, diets that are specially designed to provide high protein diets. But, you know, it's like energy drinks that are sort of marketed to people to give them more energy, and, you know, with images of athletes taking it, but it's your average truck driver who's doesn't do anything is probably consuming it, so to speak, and the same thing with protein. So I guess the one thing I thought might be worth touching upon, Stu, you just mentioned this, and it was a whole thing I wanted to get into, but we might as well do this now quickly, is you mentioned about protecting muscle tissue, which is relevant, of course, to everyone, whether they're active or not, injured or aging populations, of course. Could you just touch upon that with regards to protein intake and protecting muscle mass?
Sure. I'll answer it, and I'll add sort of another piece on there that I think is relevant. So if you sort of, you know, partition people out into fat mass and what we call fat-free mass, of course, fat-free mass would include lean or muscle and bone as well. So when you're losing weight, and so you're, you know, restricting your energy intake and or increasing your expenditure or both, then the body reacts in a way that it begins to break down, particularly if there's insufficient protein, lean mass in the form of muscle. So a great meta-analysis that was done from Wayne Campbell's group showed that on average, most weight loss diets were comprised of a loss of about 75% fat, which was great, but then 25% basically lean mass, so muscle. So, you know, to prevent the loss of muscle, which it would be relevant if you're an older person in particular, or if you would like to protect a metabolically active tissue during weight loss, then our take has been is that you necessarily have to increase your protein intake during the weight loss period. The other tissue that you would like to safeguard during that period would also be, of course, your bone mass. So if you're postmenopausal, you know, an older woman, then this would be extremely relevant. So you would like to increase your calcium and probably your vitamin D intake as well.
Mm.
So those are all things that I think are relevant in the weight loss scenario. And, you know, we've got a couple of protocols, and a lot of other people have shown this, that higher protein diets, probably up to about 1.6 gram per kilo per day, are protective of muscle during weight loss, and more so if you combine it with anabolic forms of exercise, so resistive exercise or, you know, weightlifting.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, Stu, I recall last year in around about February, we did a podcast all about gaining muscle and losing fat in an energy deficit. I just found it. Episode 74, for folks that want to get more into that. And Kevin, the other day, actually, Guru Performance, we created an info video based on one of your papers about nutrition for injury. And we can perhaps touch upon that more in a minute when we get to more performance and athlete context. But just following on from what Stu's talking about, protein and its role in protecting muscle mass, which Stu has done a great job there on. What about protein and protecting other aspects of the body that might be relevant to average people who may be active, but they're not necessarily athletes? Why may they also want to be concerned with this?
Be concerned with protein?
Yeah.
Other than muscle mass, I'm not sure what you're...
Ah, no, I'm just fishing for it. I just think, is it or is it not relevant? Like, for example, if someone is bedbound with a pretty serious illness for a few... I'm not talking in hospital necessarily, but... you know, they're spending quite a bit of time at home, you know, with a flu, they're just not active, but they do have an appetite, or they've gone skiing, just recreational skiing holiday, and they might have broken a leg or something. Is there anything they should be concerned with in that regard?
Oh, well, there are situations. Mm. So in those situations, it goes, I mean, it's the same principle as Sue was talking about. Well, in the bed rest, you know, injury situation, it's going to protect in an inactive situation that, you know, of course, Stu and Luke have done these studies with casting and very clearly that the protein intake can protect. And the one caveat, I guess, needs to be mentioned is that those studies are done in healthy individuals and there really haven't been any studies done in injured athletes to see if it protects immediately after the injury or when they're in a cast. There have been a couple of studies done when they're recovering, so they're in the anabolic stage after, you know, once the cast comes off and they're trying to get back into it. But so presumably, it would apply that you could apply that kind of logic to it. Certainly, don't think it would hurt to sort of increase protein intake. Not to mention, for some of the reasons that Stu mentioned earlier about weight control and things like that, which of course, if you're less active because of an injury. But for other tissues too, we talk about bone, and I know students fight people on Twitter about this before. Bone thick protein back for bone. But, you know, my granny show clearly that remember bone is a matrix of protein, of collagen primarily, and with minerals. But you got to have that protein matrix response. It responds to protein intake. So it's actually a positive thing for bone as well. Now, whether it increases healing or whatever, I don't think we know for sure. But in theory, you at least want to keep it up. You definitely don't want a deficiency now. I don't know how high you really need to go, but it's something to consider anyway.
Sure. No, well, I just thought it'd be interesting. You know, people do funny things when they're ill and they don't necessarily consume, protein-rich foods in that scenario, and it may or may not be relevant. But anyway, let's just move on a bit. So what I want to do just quickly is discuss what happens, Kevin, again, actually. So when you consume protein, it's not really a case of, you eat your your chicken breast or your piece of steak, and then you get all of that protein go straight to the muscles. There's quite a lot involved from consumption to delivery, shall we say. Digestion, absorption, transportation, and then there's the whole, obviously, muscle protein synthesis and so on. And we'll develop that into the whole MPS and hypertrophy thing as well with Stu. But just from ingestion, I mean, what's actually happening here?
Well, you're absolutely right, of course, that you got to take the protein. If you get a chicken breast, for example, and that protein then is digested, and then it's going to be broken down into free amino acids, but also into di and tripeptides. There's a large portion of amino acids that appear in the blood coming in as di and tripeptide, in addition to free amino acids. And then the liver gets cracked these, and some of Luke Malone studies show, and there were some older studies with some results, sort of 67% make it past the liver or come out of the liver. The rest of the liver tank uses fake proteins and some for liver proteins in the liver, but also making other proteins like albumin, for example, that it'll use to other functions. And then those amino acids go out into the blood, into the arterial blood, and then delivered to the muscles, as you said. And that's what can be taken up by the muscles if in whatever proportion, depending on the situation, activity, etc.
So thanks, Kevin. So Stu, so when we've digested and absorbed the protein in it eventually becomes these amino acids, and we'll get into this in a bit more detail in a minute. Those amino acids aren't just suddenly building muscle tissue, are they? So the bricks are being delivered to the building site, but are they, are all those bricks becoming a house or a wall, or what's happening with those bricks, and what ultimately determines the transformation of those bricks into actual muscle tissue?
Yeah, no, you're entirely correct. They're not all converted into the wall by any means. I mean, there are lots of other protein-containing structures. Kevin mentioned, and I think it's worth repeating, that, the newsflash, I think, for a number of people is to learn that bone is, about 45% by composition protein. It's not just a stick of chalk. So it's important that, people realize when these amino acids are delivered, they are incorporated into things other than the what we call force-generating or myofibrillar proteins within the muscle. There are lots of other protein-containing structures, mitochondria, enzymes. There's other things that require amino acids in, similarly in other cells in the body, so the liver, the brain, the skin, all kinds of tissues. Your heart has protein-containing structures that are being remodeled. So it's the decisions about where those amino acids go are usually probably proportional to the amount of protein that's there, but then also the rate at which it turns over. The one thing that we do know that obviously greatly accelerates the rate at which these amino acid bricks are put into the muscle wall is the performance of exercise, and particularly resistance exercise, because that's going to stimulate the direction of the flow of those amino acids into myofibrillar or force-generating proteins.
So, also, when we're talking about muscle hypertrophy, and I don't mean to put too much time into the actual mechanisms of muscle protein synthesis, I've covered that a lot of times over various episodes of various people, but specifically with this topic of protein, there are all sorts of scenarios where people will consume protein in different quantities. They will sometimes have access to protein sometimes they don't have access to protein or protein sources or quality protein sources because they're traveling or they have a week where they just can't afford stuff. The sort of the balance of amino acids that are circulating in the body. What is the impact of the total type and timing, if you like, of protein intake relative to, you know, established or built muscle mass? And if your day-to-day intake of protein intake is going up and down, does that mean that your muscle mass protein content is going up and down relative to, you know, to that variability from diet? Or is there a sort of a protective mechanism there as well that adjusts up and down based on what, you know, the body, the host, if you like, is experiencing in the real world?
So, I mean, I think if I'm understanding your question is, you know, is there day-to-day sort of variability in these things? And the answer would be, you know, yes, but on a very, very small scale. I think we can probably say with some confidence that if you were to drop your protein intake or, you know, drastically alter the quality of the protein, so switch from, say, all animal to all plant, then you can expect to see some changes. But, you know, we have a remarkable ability as human beings to adapt. And it's one of the things that I have to chuckle about when people say, you know, we're going back to our roots when we're eating like this. And, you know, if human beings couldn't adapt to changing situations, we'd all be dead by now. So we can survive on 100% or close to 100%, you know, carbs or fats or proteins or, you know, mixture of plants or animal. It doesn't really matter. So unless you practice something consistently vis-a-vis your protein intake, I don't think you're going to notice much of a change. I think for most people, they would say that if they exert a consistent, you know, training program and they hold their dietary protein intake at a certain level, then they begin to see changes. But, you know, muscle mass changes very, very slowly. It's not a rapidly turning over tissue. So it takes a while to see increases. But probably, having said that, shorter than we realized. We used to say sort of 7 to 8 weeks. I'm beginning to revise that estimate and say it's probably something between 5 to 6 to 7 weeks. It depends who you are, what you're doing, and a few other things. But I don't think it changed an awful lot, to be honest with you.
Okay. So over the course of some previous podcasts, particularly when we've been talking about things like nutritional periodization, we've been coming up with terms like nutritional training. For example, with Louise Burke, we were talking about, actually, I promised we weren't going to get into this topic, but I'll skim past it. But the whole low carb, high fat thing, but there is an issue with extreme manipulation of certain substrates like carbohydrate or fats, because it can affect metabolic flexibility, for example, i.e. constantly cutting out carbs so that you can oxidize or burn more fats might make you burn more fat, but it would also be at the expense of being able to oxidize or utilize carbohydrates effectively, especially in a like a race situation. Being able to switch from one fuel source to another could be an issue. So with protein, and bearing in mind there's lots of different amino acids and there are all sorts of ways people approach their consumption and I guess nutritional training with their protein, i.e. they might go through periods of low protein intake and then suddenly have high periods of high protein intake, or variations on protein quality. Does that training influence how the body can utilize protein or extract the amino acids and then ultimately convert that to muscle? Is there, if that made any sense to you, is there something there?
I think so.
Go for it, Kevin.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I think what Stu said, I would totally agree with, which is, you know, it's not really on a micro scale, which is kind of what some people do, is try to match on a hourly basis protein intake. And you know, it's going to be more, I think, on a bit longer scale, because as Stu said, you know, muscle protein turned over pretty slowly. And you know, if you do get a situation, let's say, where you're low energy for, you know, a few days or a couple days even, possibly, you're probably going to lose some protein, but you're probably not going to notice it, or be certainly not be able to measure it in those 1 or 2 days. But if you do it for a prolonged period of time, you start seeing muscle loss. And that's because, whereas Stu's right, you don't really have a storage form of protein per se. If you get into a starvation situation, then your muscle is going to be the place where the body goes to get the amino acids it needs for other activities that it needs the amino acids for. But I don't really think that protein intake needs to be matched on a very short time scale, but probably on a longer time scale if situational, you might have advantages to manipulate your protein. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's just as we start to look at factors like nutrient, you know, partitioning, and all the way through to sense, you know, nutrient sensing. Had fascinating lecture by Lee Hamilton, Kevin from your group. It's been a couple of years now, but it still sticks with me as one of the most fascinating lectures I ever heard.
You could understand?
Pardon?
You could actually understand what he was saying?
I didn't say I understood it. I just said it was fascinating. Yeah, no, the beauty of filming these lectures is I can watch them 90 times. No, it was amazing. And I guess since we're talking about it, Kevin, maybe we could just quickly talk about this concept of sensing and how that relates to this protein discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still a lot to be learned about that, particularly by me. I assume you're talking about sort of, you know, how the muscle senses what's there and then
yes,
decides what to do with it.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Well, you know, certainly there are amino acid transporters on the muscle that will get the amino acids from the blood or interstitial fluid into the muscle itself, and it seems, and I was doing some data from a study a few years ago, a couple studies, and there are other studies that those amino acid transporters, at least on a transcriptome level, tend to respond to proteins. So the idea would be that with higher protein intake or with a larger protein dose, that you're going to get more of these transporters active. But we also know that those transporters, certain transporters transport multiple amino acids, and there tends to be some competition that can influence things. And again, Stu should probably be answering this because, you know, Tyler Church-Rabene studies were really good at kind of trying to manipulate those kind of things to see how that impacted the what happens with protein synthesis. So at sensing level, the amino acid transport certainly has something to say about it. And then, of course, you get into the muscle and, you know, as Dr. Lee talked a lot about, I know I listened to that podcast. I don't remember what I had for lunch yesterday, so I can't remember exactly what he said. But I'm sure he talked about mTOR and that pathway, which is the one that gets the most attention, and of course that is very responsive to both protein or amino acids coming into the muscle, but also activity. Well, so I don't know if I really answered your question.
No, you did. I just think it's interesting what we're starting to learn. You know, researchers like yourselves are contributing vast amounts of knowledge for us to consume. And you know, where we were many years ago was very basic understanding of what protein is and what it does. and particularly with the advent of molecular biology, you know, techniques that, that you guys are now able to utilize, it's the depth of understanding, particularly as you go into the muscle and understand what's actually happening in there, rather than just sort of a more observational stuff that was done many years ago. I find that, I mean, I've done lots of podcasts with lots of people about the sort of various molecular biology stuff, and I do think it's very interesting. I think it's very interesting the influence that protein has, the ingestion of protein and the sort of incorporation of protein into the body. It's not just the, as Stu gave a, you know, great overview of the bricks forming you know, buildings, etc., but of course the there's communication between muscles, between cells and tissues, and these amino acids play a role in that, don't they, Stu? There's a lot of talk going on at the molecular level.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's that whole area is, I mean, we used to sort of be, you know, neurotransmitters obviously have been around for a long time, a lot of which are, you know, close to single amino acid based or small peptides. But we're beginning now to understand certain hormonal factors that circulate. There are factors that, instead of being hormones, that is, they go from one tissue in the bloodstream, have an action on another. They're autocrine in action. So a tissue produces it and it acts, you know, on itself, or paracrine. There's another tissue in close proximity to the tissue. And now I think we're also beginning to recognize the existence of things called exosomes, which are small packages of all kinds of things, RNAs, proteins, microRNAs, that are transferred between tissues, that probably explain a lot of the reasons why, for example, why is exercise, which, you know, we can understand the effects on our heart, our lungs, our blood vessels, our muscles, and maybe our bone, but why does it do something to our brain? Why does it do something to, you know, sexual function? Things that are just so remotely sort of connected, you would wonder why. So I think we're scratching the surface on that now. And it's, you know, it's an area which I'm sure, you know, we're going to learn a lot about over the next few years for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's super fascinating, and I mean, well beyond the realms of what we can get into in this conversation. But for example, the reason why I was mentioning that is you often hear people talk about protein quality, and it's a fairly simplistic conversation normally that relates to the types of amino acids and, you know, is it a complete protein, or, you know, they talk about biological value, and of course there's different ways of, you know, quantifying value, and obviously, you know, maybe we could get into that briefly, but what I'm interested in here, as it relates to us as consumers of a diet and consumers of this information that influences what we eat, is the impact that could have on not just muscle, but on how the muscle functions and communicates and responds to training in terms of adaptation and recovery and all that sort of thing. So in terms of quality, Kevin, perhaps you could just quickly describe what we mean by protein quality, and then the relevance that does actually have to muscle, since muscle, we're going to be muscle centric, I guess, from now on in this podcast. But what is the relevance of quality anyway, in terms of protein intake for active people?
Okay, I just want to go back to for a second, just to make
Please
a comment.
Do. Yeah.
About the you know, sort of molecular techniques and that stuff. And as you say, it's fascinating and it's very interesting mechanistically. But what I've noticed is that a lot of people, a lot of practitioners, and you know, people trying to apply this information tend to be at least tempted to use the molecular findings to then inform their decisions on how to apply some sort of nutritional or exercise regime. And I think that's an area that's fraught with peril, because, you know, we're talking mechanistic information that doesn't necessarily translate up to the kind of outcomes that you're looking for. But it might not. And then some of the measurements that are made, the way they're made, or have limitations that yet they're not, et cetera. So I think to purely base an applied or practical application of something on a molecular technique without other supporting information is kind of dangerous. But to your question about quality, well, you know, when classically, you know, when I was doing my PhD and stuff, you had all the sorts of protein values, biological value, et cetera, ECAS. And so, but if you're talking about muscle-centric, then those aren't always the best ways to evaluate it. And of course, you know, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, that leucine is the star amino acid, and everybody is all worked up about leucine. And so it does seem that leucine is a key. And I think it was Stu and Lee Breen that first published the leucine threshold note, and of if we're to maximize protein, for instance, you can hit the minimum value of leucine as quickly as possible for the protein. And so if you talk about a muscle level, then protein quality could be considered a protein that can provide as much leucine as the other essential amino acids into muscle in a relatively quick fashion. And I think, you know, at least most people agree with that kind of concept. And so if you go with that, then in general, the animal proteins are higher quality, most plant proteins. And actually, Luke published a review paper recently which compared the amino acid profiles of all those different types of proteins. But that being said, we've not really done studies directly comparing a lot of these different types of protein. So I think probably those sorts of things need to be done to really determine how much difference some of these small differences in the amounts of leucine and other amino acids might make as far as the performance, at least the protein synthesis, and then also, you know, that which sometimes is an indicator of gains in muscle mass.
I mean a theme that comes up, I mean, I've had, you know, as you know, nearly 100 of these conversations with all sorts of people, but there is a theme in my research, because this has been a research tool for my DPROF, as you know. But one thing that kept coming up was, and you'd sort of elucidated to this, Kevin, where you're talking about people love to talk about, you know, science, complex terminology, and they like to talk about molecular stuff, but does it actually translate to anything, you know, actually worthwhile in the real world? And it's a very different conversation, albeit it's not as sexy a conversation, but the phraseology that sort of goes with it in this podcast series is very much, you know, yeah, you can do it, but should you? And it's the should you question that I think people spend less time on, is like, you know, why would I want to do this, and what is the relevance of it? So I guess, Stu, in that mindset, you know, the obvious conversation here is there's a lot of people who talk about, well, how much protein should I have? And, you know, that's a big question, because there's all sorts of contexts and so on. But lots of people will start, you know, throwing papers at people and saying, this paper says X amount of grams per kilogram, and, you know, this one says it's got to be whey, and that one's this and that one's that. But just from a practical standpoint, if someone had to take just one thing away from this podcast in terms of, well, you know, they understand how important protein is, blah, 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 but how much should they actually have? I mean, how should we... You know, how do you feel we should be taking that message?
Yeah, so I think that there are probably two answers that, if you're going to walk away, I think are pretty important. One is, I think beyond about 1.6, 1.7 grams per kilo per day, the benefits of protein diminish pretty sharply. In other words, you're not going to grow any more muscle. You're not really going to repair anything faster. your body just simply can't use it. You know, the time in our lives when we could make use of protein at the most rapid rate was obviously when we were kids, when we were, you know, infants, when we were just growing, and those times are long gone. So as adults, it's a bit naive to think that you can just keep piling on top more and more protein and your body can make use of it. So beyond about 1.6, 1.7 grams per kilo, I think things begin to drop off. Now, you can eat more. Don't get me wrong. You can eat, you know, 2-3 times as much as that, but it's certainly not being utilized by your body to gain more muscle, to help you repair, you know, injury or something faster. Even patients in intensive care units don't get protein up to those sorts of level, and they're in a critically catabolic state. So I think what's really important beyond that then is to think about dividing those doses of protein into sort of discrete meal doses, which are probably about 0.4 grams per kilo per meal, maybe. And that's the sort of per meal dose that your body can make use of and turn into muscle tissue and be used for all sorts of other things. And it's unlikely you can hit the system, if you like, more than about 3-4 times in a day. So, you know, at the very outside, I think we're talking about, well, maybe up to 2 grams per kilo for overreaching, highly stressed, you know, maybe trying to modify their body composition athletes. But, you know, if you just sort of keep piling it on beyond that, I think you're not really going to notice more benefit.
And just because this topic, we've actually, in our original podcast, we got into this and we got into it again last year, and I've discussed this in detail with Lee Breen. But just to, you know, distance ourselves from just the sciencey side of it, but the sort of the take home reality of it, because people can get pretty anxious if they've missed a protein feed. Or after a workout, they start freaking out because they realize they haven't packed their protein shake. Realistically, even if you were to get your, you know, your basic daily total in over just say 2 feeds, how significant is that relative to say the 3 or 4 feeds? I know one is optimal relative to the other, but optimal could be understood in different ways. It's not necessarily critical, is it?
Well, I certainly think if people are thinking about it on a meal-to-meal basis and you miss a protein meal feed and you freak out, or you have an anxious moment over what it is that you just didn't do for yourself, then you might have a problem beyond, you know, what I can advise you on. In other words, you've probably got an obsessive-compulsive issue that's creating that type of anxiety. So, yes, if you miss a meal, you'll be fine.
There's a lot of those about. Meals,
yeah. Well, if you eat 2 meals and they're larger, I think that, you know, again, I come back to, can you make use of that amount of protein in a meal? And I'm not sure that you can. But what's the difference between 2-3 meals or 5 meals? The answer is very little in my book. So I don't think that there's any documented science advantage to, you know, 5 meals per day versus 3 meals per day. I say 4, or and that includes, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as a pre-sleep snack, which contains protein. And I think, you know, there's a concept that that has some real legs in terms of if you're not doing it right now, I do think that it can help regenerate damaged muscle or remodel muscle proteins. But in all truth, you know, over the long run, it might be optimal, but it, you know, for most mere mortals, it's not going to matter that much.
Yeah, I had a really great chat with Luke Van Loon all about that whilst he was eating lunch. Fascinating. Couldn't differentiate his eating of food and his Dutch accent, but anyway. Kevin, just to bring us back, we briefly mentioned about this, you know, from digestion, absorption, and transportation, and there were some things there. As it relates to workout nutrition and what we were just discussing with Stu there, you know, people freaking out about their post-workout intake of protein. Of course, you don't just eat your chicken breast and then magically the amino acids are instantaneously available. In fact, you could eat a meal, you know, a couple hours before a workout, and those rich in protein, those amino acids are about to become available. You know, they'll be available to the muscles post-workout. I mean, that's probably a more important issue, isn't it? Maybe what you ate, you know, earlier in the day, perhaps, relative to your workout.
Yeah, I mean, we did a study with Luke, actually. Ollie Wittard led the study and showed that, you do get a response of muscle protein synthesis if you eat a meal 3 hours before the exercise. So, I mean, I think it's probably a little bit, and we've done some timing studies in Galveston as well, and it seems to not matter much depending on what it is that you're looking at. So I think you're right. I think people tend to get, was alluding to this, I think people get tend to get too caught up in all these on these details about, you know, oh, should I eat 5 or 6 meals? Should I try to stimulate my mTOR with, give these precise numbers of all these things?
Mm.
Instead of just sort of take the overall general concepts and trying to use those more effectively. And that's, you see so many really people obsessed with all these different details, and it's probably unnecessary. And in fact, I would argue that most people, they fool themselves into trying to worry about nutritional details instead of actually working harder. And that's where the actual adaptations come from. And the nutrition is just there to support the work that they're doing.
Sure. And Stu, I know you got to go in a minute, so we'll wrap this up. I actually, I can't believe that we've been talking for an hour here. I mean, I feel like we barely got started, which is typical about this stuff. And there's just so many things we could have talked about. And there's, lots of other episodes people can refer back to. But if we just bring this then to those three concepts that would relate to sort of, the periodization, if you like, of nutrition, or how we would approach this strategically, the three T's, total, type, and timing. So, Kevin, just super quickly then, what would be the general advice to active people in terms of total protein then? What in a nutshell should they be looking for to at least make sure that they're pretty much getting it right in terms of protein intake?
I think we've covered it. It's, so 1.6, 1.7, possibly a little bit more, up to 2 or so in certain situations if you're trying to lose weight or alter body composition, defend muscle when you're trying to lose weight or possibly during injury. And then, also I completely agree with what Stu said is, I think that it's probably, at least what we know now, advantageous to try to divide that amount into sort of relatively equal doses as opposed to what most people do naturally, which is eat less in the morning and more in the evening.
Mm.
And then you get a sort of a diminished returns with the one in the evening and don't get as big a response in the morning. So maybe try to even that out a little bit. And I think that that's probably a sensible thing to do to try to optimize the protein intake.
So personal preference is clearly also something that we should bear in mind. And that can play a role. We don't have to sort of force them into a sort of theoretical strategy, which I think is important. Some people do that. And then, Stu, just quickly, we haven't gotten into this so much, but maybe you can do a super quick one on this type of protein. I mean, how concerned should we be about, plant-based, animal-based, the arguments that you see in the literature about whey being supreme and so on. I mean, how much attention should we put to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear, like Kevin said, that, leucine is the highlight. I mean, it's the amino acid, it's the building block it's not just a building block, it turns the process of protein synthesis on. So the quality of, animal-based proteins like whey, for example, it has that reputation/classification by virtue of the science that we understand about leucine content. And there's not too many other proteins out there that are
as high in leucine as whey. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, soy isolate or, you know, other sources of protein are poor sources of protein, pea or rice or something like that. But people need to appreciate that the leucine content of those proteins is lower, so you can compensate for it. And this is what people have done in some studies by just having people consume more of those proteins. So there's a little bit of a cost to pay, but if you're a young, healthy, active person, chances are those things begin to matter less and less. If you're an older, a little bit sedentary, or you're diabetic, you have other issues, then those things are going to matter. I got into a little bit of an argument the other day with a guy who was a urologist and deals with people with kidney failure, and he was telling me that these people need to be on a plant protein diet. And I said, that's crazy. It seems to me that on the low protein diets you prescribe for these people, they should be on the highest quality protein possible. And that's, you know, those are animal proteins. I'm sorry, that's not a bias. That's science.
Yeah.
So does it matter? The more compromised you are, probably yes, but for most other people, probably not.
Yeah. And of course that, you know, that argument rages out in the health and fitness arena. So your answer helps to clarify that. And then Kevin, last of two points I want to get into. So timing. I know Stu sort of got into it with sort of protein meal spacing, that sort of thing, but how concerned should be with timing of protein intake, given, as we inferred earlier, people really do get stressed about, you know, making sure that they hit their post-workout protein intake. You know, how relevant is that? How concerned should we be with timing?
I think people worry about it too much, for sure. I mean, you know, Stu's studies show that that the muscle is responsive to protein, more responsive for at least 24 hours after exercise. Mm. Now, is it more responsive immediately after than 24 hours after? Probably. I mean, we really haven't, nobody's done that direct comparison. But you know, if you get protein in within, you know, near the exercise, probably within a couple of hours, I think you're fine. Most people, it's certainly not the, you know, there have been several books written about the anabolic window or the metabolic window of opportunity. Mm. They're suggesting even 45 minutes is where the cutoff is, and that's just, I think, ridiculous. In fact, we have studies from Nelson showing that the response to amino acids 3 hours after is the same as, you know, 1 hour after. So I'm not sure how important it is. I really wouldn't stress over it. That being said, most people eat within a couple hours after the exercise all the time anyway. Mm. So it's, you know, if you forgot your protein shake and you're worried that you're not going to, there's traffic, you won't get home in time, I don't think you're going to be like the Wicked Witch of the West and melt okay before you get there. So
sure. Yeah, no, I mean, the one thing that does spring to mind, of course, is if you're a really big guy, you know, some of the huge rugby players I work with, or bodybuilders, you know, people who do need to consume huge amounts of protein for a very good reason, then getting into a good habit of supplementing their diet with that post-workout thing is a very pragmatic factor. So look, anyway, I know Stu's got to go. Thanks, Stu, for hanging on as long as you have. It's been great.
No problem. My pleasure, as always.
Yeah, no, thanks, mate. We'll catch up soon.
All right, take care, guys. Okay. Good chatting.
Okay, and then Kevin, just one last point. I wanted to get into safety, if you've got a few minutes still.
Okay.
It is something that comes up a lot. People start going nuts over. I mean, Stu just gave us a perfect idea, actually. You know, the some people in the medical fraternity will apply, and dietetics as well, still have this concern about protein being a problem at high levels. Perhaps you could just clarify for those that, you know, obviously for those that don't have a medical problem, should they be worried about this?
I don't think it's a general statement. Stu was talking about the nephrologist, so sure, if something has a kidney issue, then high protein intake could be a problem. And I suppose that there could, you know, you could envision a situation where someone might have a subclinical underlying kidney issue that they're not aware of, and so then a very high protein diet could put them into trouble. But if you do some of the sort of theoretical calculations of what we know about the body's ability to synthesize urea, and then you know the what we know about how much protein is incorporated into muscle, you know, it's eaten, and what's used by the liver, etc. And you these calculations, if you get these really really high amounts of protein, people can theoretically tolerate. Now those studies haven't really been done. I won't go on about it, but there's some really fun information about that I wrote in a review paper a few years ago. There's a fellow, I want to say his name is Vilhelmur, something, he was Canadian, but of Icelandic extraction, and he did an experiment on himself. This was sort of around 1900. And so there's really fun reports about that. I mean, you got Babbitt starvation syndrome, where guys out in the mountain west of the States, the mountaineers, you know, like you see in the old movies and stuff, mountain men. And they would, in the winter, they would often have these problems because they ate pretty much, you know, rabbits and other meat, or the vegetation to eat up in the mountains in that time of year. So they did get in trouble. So there is a limit. There's no question. I think it's so high that, you know, it has to be these really weird situations, and or, as you said right at the top, some sort of clinical situation where people are going to get into it. And if people are eating sort of up to or 2.5 grams per kilo and they don't have a clinical problem, I can't see why that's going to be an issue for the most part. Now, that's kind of a point. A lot of people worry about home, as we've said before, but again, the danger of bone is we saw are primarily epidemiological, and I think overblown for that reason, overinterpreted. And again, there's no real evidence for it. Stu's written a couple of nice papers on that as well. So yeah, I think for most people, unless they're at these really crazy high levels, there's really nothing that I would say they need to worry about.
Sure. No, that's great. And then just one last point then, and then I'll let you go, is the sort of food v supplements type concept. You know, as performance nutritionists, we like to extol the food first concept. Now, of course, there's different ways of understanding what we mean by food, because a lot of protein supplements still are food, but you know, in terms of our approach to getting our protein intake in, what would you have to say about food and supplements? You know, where is the role for supplements specifically, and how important is, you know, is trying to optimize food first, do you think?
Well, the role for supplements, in my opinion, is the word to sum it up would be convenience. There's nothing magic about supplements. Supplements are merely providing the nutrient, right? So again, for, like you suggested, for some of these athletes, big rugby players or other athletes, really busy, maybe a supplement's a good way to you know, get the protein in a convenient way without having to cook it. But I don't think there haven't been a lot of comparisons, so it's very difficult to say whether, you know, a whey shake is better than a chicken breast as far as what happens in the muscle. In the long run, I can't imagine it's very important. And for most people that, you know, that aren't at the very, very elite level, then I can't think it's important. So, you know, food, you know, a nice chicken breast or a steak tastes good. So probably, you know, why not eat the food and not get too hung up on the supplements? Plus, for the most part, protein and food is cheaper than supplements. So, you know, supplements are convenient if it works for people to do that, and if they want to have their protein bar or protein shake, fine. But it's not critical, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I would just add in from a sort of from a nutritionist perspective, the advantage of promoting a food first approach is, for example, when they're eating that nice tasty chicken breast you mentioned, they will tend to eat other things with it, like vegetables, that sort of thing, in a meal. And with that comes lots of benefits. Obviously, it's more nutrient dense and complete meal by virtue of the nutrients in the vegetables and the fiber and all the other stuff. But also it's from a social psychological perspective, it's probably healthier to have that meal with, you know, in the right setting with people and conversation and so on. One of the problems with I see, particularly with physique athletes, is they can be very much about consuming their protein as just protein and not actually as food with other foods. So whilst they're hitting their protein numbers, their intakes, they're drastically missing out on other nutrition components, which has profound influences on their health, you know, and so on.
That reminds me, though, of,
yeah,
you know, sort of the opposite perspective was presented to us a couple of years ago when we went to an ethics committee meeting, and they were concerned about us giving, this one person was concerned about us giving supplements because, as you know, in our studies, because it's just the easiest way to do it in a laboratory, we give the supplements after the exercise to see what the effect is.
Yeah.
Necessarily studying the supplement per se. So she was concerned about this, and she said, so why don't you, you know, give your protein, you know, in another form, in food? And, you know, we're, and I said, well, it's easier this way for me. She said, well, I'm just concerned about this. I think you should use broccoli. And I just was so taken aback. I said, what? Yeah. Broccoli, I thought that's a really good source of protein. It's very, very high in protein. And I thought, I was thinking for a second, then it hit me what she was talking about. I said, so you're saying that broccoli is high in protein, you know, on a per calorie basis? And she said, yeah, that's what I've read. I said, well, that may be true. But, you know, in order to give 30 grams of protein after exercise, you would have to give them like 10 pounds of broccoli. Don't think that's a very pragmatic way to get your protein.
Yeah, you know, I'd love to see in the gym locker room, though, Kevin, people, you know, out of their gym bags, they're whipping out huge bunches of broccoli for their post-workout broccoli intake. There might be something there. I think you've got to do a study just to see.
I don't think we can get people to eat enough broccoli.
No. Well, especially not up in Scotland.
Yeah, exactly.
Dear, oh, dear. Well, look, we've been talking enough, and we've already run Stu off, so I'll let you get back to the Highlands, Kevin.
All right.
So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much. I will, of course, add to the podcast page various links to a few papers, your ResearchGate account, that sort of thing, and also back to that episode 5 and episode 74, where we covered a lot of these topics. So thank you, Kevin. I do appreciate it, and look forward to having you back soon.
My pleasure. Glad to talk to y'all. Good man.
And for everyone listening, just if you go to our website at guruperformance.com, you'll see all sorts of the podcast is there. You can look up all the episodes there. We've got infographics and info videos. As I mentioned, we've done a few related to this topic, including Kevin's paper on nutrition for injury. We just done one on that. And of course, our educational programs in applied sport and exercise nutrition. Check all of that out on our website at guruperformance.com. I, of course, am Laurent Bannock, and look forward to bringing another episode back to you all very soon.